It is Masters Week. If you haven't heard from your friends that are huge golf fans, basically telling you don't call all week, I'm actually convinced that some of my friends block me during the week of the Masters. They just want to be left alone. So it's golf week, and I thought the Kilcoin conversation may be the perfect time to check in with Jay Randolph Sr. For many years, a voice on golf on NBC, only called one Masters. That surprised me. I didn't realize that. But it's the famous one around here in 1968 when Belleville's own Bob Golby wins the green jacket. So we're talking to Jay about the Masters. He played there as a young golfer. The brain is sharp. Let me just tell you that. And he joked when we talked the other day, you know, at age 87, he said, my hair is in good shape. My voice is in good shape. But I got some other health problems. I said, you know what? A TV sports guy, you got your voice and your hair. That's a pretty good start. And we go from Masters into his career. I knew he ended up in St. Louis coming from the Dallas Cowboys, came here to do the football Cardinals, never was really sure why, ended up being the original TV voice of the St. Louis Blues. And a funny story from Jay, how he really, well, he didn't know a whole lot about hockey. A fun career to kind of look back on, working at NBC in St. Louis, KSDK, but also traveling for NBC Network, doing bowling and golf and college basketball and NFL football and the Olympics. I think he went to four or five different Olympic games. And we'll get into the career with Jay, some funny stories, some word association with the people he knows well, Jack Buck, Mike Shannon, coming across a young Bob Costas. So storytelling time with Jay Randolph Sr. Kilcoin Conversation is presented by Marie Davila Senior Living. They are located on Weidman and Clayton Road, West County, St. Louis. Beautiful campus out there. Love the fact they flipped the lights. The fountains were flipped red to kick off opening week of Cardinal baseball. Always festive out there. Just a great place to check out. Take a virtual tour at mariedavila.com. Also, Triad Bank, great sponsors of all of our programming. Martin and Marlowe, hanging with Big Walt, the Kilcoin Conversation. You know, they love St. Louis content because they are a St. Louis-based bank. 2005 is when they opened their doors, and since then, they've really grown their product by working directly with their customers. Saw it firsthand during the pandemic. I know a lot of people who have small businesses that bank with Triad, and Jim Regnan, the CEO, was there late at night in the early days of the pandemic talking to them about the government program, seeing what's available to make sure they navigate through the struggle of the pandemic. Just great people. Triad Bank, located in Frontenac, on the web. It's triadbanking.com. And also Appliance Discounters. It's real simple. Appliance Discounters is well aware of all the cannots those other appliance guys are telling you about when you need that appliance right away. Well, Appliance Discounters wants to make your life easier, offering a full in-stock 40,000 square foot warehouse. It's full of GE appliances, General Electric. Need I say more? Times are difficult enough. Why wait 2 to 3 months for your appliance when you can get it in just a couple of days? Lowest price, GE rebates, great service, and in stock only at Appliance Discounters. Shop at any of the showrooms or go online at theappliancediscounters.com. And as always, our savings are your savings. And let's get to it. The man with the great voice and the fascinating career, Jay Randolph Sr.
Well, on Masters Week, those of us who have never been to Augusta, I think we sort of have it in our mind what it looks like, what it feels like. Jay Randolph has been there, has called golf there. Welcome to the show. It's good to talk to you, and I should call you more often than just Masters Week. It's sort of cliche, isn't it? Oh, I need to call my buddy Jay, and I waited till Masters Week. That is a bad cliche.
Well, there's nothing wrong with cliches in our business. You know that.
That's true. Hey, paint a picture for me. If I were to go to Augusta, is it really that awe-inspiring?
Well, if you're a golfer or if you have followed the Masters on television in recent years, it is a very special place to drive down Magnolia Lane and to stop at the clubhouse and then have the opportunity to maybe have lunch or a pimento cheese sandwich and head out on the golf course and take a look at it. It's really a very unusual piece of ground. Bob Jones and the late Clifford Roberts, investment banker from New York, put this club together. And basically, it's on a piece of ground, really, Martin, that is a lot hillier than people realize, because you don't see the real design of the golf course so much, but it's a very hilly golf course. There isn't a hole on the course that doesn't have elevation of some kind, either up or down. And it's a wonderful golf course. This week, it's going to be very tough if the weather stays the way it is, because the course is reportedly fast and hard the way it can be, and it is tough when it's fast and hard. And it's going to be a very interesting tournament this week, of course, being played so early in the year with this new arrangement that the PGA Tour has of the schedule. And the other item certainly about the Masters is it's an invitational field, great players, and the fact that, you know, we know this golf course. We've seen it so many times on television. We know the back nine with the opportunity to make big moves back there with the two par fives. We have seen it time and time again. It's a golf course that creates really wonderful, wonderful golf from the players who are trying to win the tournament. If you're in the mix there, it's very interesting. And I have to say that I first went there in 1954, and I had the opportunity to not play at that time. I played it five times, but I went there in 54. That was the year that Hogan and Snead tied, and Billy Joe Patton, the amateur from Lumberton, North Carolina, almost won the tournament, and he finished third. And 2 weeks after that, at Pinehurst, North Carolina, the North-South Amateur, I was up against Billy Joe Patton in the third round, and had him two down after nine holes, and then he birdied three of the next six, and I was going home. But Patton was a fantastic amateur and longtime member at Augusta. They gave him a membership after he almost won that tournament in 54. But the golf course is really special, and the way they do things there. I mean, Clifford Roberts, investment banker, kind of always in the shadows there, but always making the decisions, most of them the right decisions, and the tournament has grown, of course. It's the only major that is played in the same place every year, and Augusta National brings out the great players, but also it brings out remarkable tests for them, and many of them, especially the guys that win, play maybe the best golf of their lives there, because the putting is such a there's probably no course day in and day out where good putting is what you really have. If you're not putting well, you're not going to be in contention at Augusta.
So here's the line of the week. Jay on the phone the other day says to me, my hair and my voice are in great shape. And I said, what else do you need? Are you 86? Is that right?
87.
You sound fantastic. And all of these memories are like they were 2 days ago. But what really, what amazes me is all the golf you called over the course of your career. Only did the Masters one time, and it happened to be 1968. And you're a St. Louis guy at that point, Camel X, and maybe Channel 5. But the 1 year you do the Masters is when the kid from Belleville wins, Bob Golby. I mean, what an amazing, you know, occurrence of events for you.
Well, I was working at that time at KMOX Radio. I'd come here to do the football Cardinals and anything else that Bob Hyland wanted me to do. I came here from Dallas, where I'd done the Cowboy Network. And it was a situation where Frank Cherkinian, the late, great golf producer at CBS, got a hold of me and gave me three tournaments to do, the Masters, the Carling World Open, and I don't even remember what the third tournament was. So, but anyway, I'm doing the Masters in 68, and of course, Golby wins.
Here at the 14th, Bob Golby Goldie now 9-under par. Working with me here at 14, Byron Nelson. This is Jay Randolph. He's going to use the Texas wedge from off the edge. Here at the 14th, this 420-yard par 4, Golby now 10-under par, one shot back of Roberto DiVincenzo. A superb 3 for Bob Golby.
And it was a great thrill for me to be able to corral him down in the old media area and get him on the air to KMOX radio and do an interview with him. And Bob and I have been great friends over the years and, of course, worked together for 13 seasons at NBC doing golf. And Bob did a wonderful job and a lot of people criticize the way he won the tournament when DiVincenzo was involved in signing an incorrect card. And a lot of people forget that Bob Golby shot 66 on that Sunday. And he really maybe didn't get the great adulation that he deserved because DiVincenzo is a very popular player from South America, of course, and wonderful to watch him strike the ball. But Golby has done so much for the game. In later years, he was at the forefront of creating the Champions Tour and negotiated the first TV contract for the Champions Tour, which has now grown into a tremendous success out there. And it's given a lot of the great old stars of Mulligan the chance to come out and play. And golf, you can do that. You can play in your 60s and 70s.
I got to go back because, and I'm sure we've talked about it at some point, you left the Dallas Cowboys to call the football Cardinals. That would shock some people. Tell me about that move and how it played out.
Well, I was in Oklahoma City. They were opening a new building, and they had a doubleheader basketball game there, and Jack Buck came down from St. Louis to do the Billikens and Oklahoma. And I did Oklahoma State and their game and the doubleheader that evening at the new facility in Oklahoma City. And afterwards, we went back over to the Skirvin Hotel where we're all staying. And there was a little lounge off the portico of the hotel there, the Gollywog Lounge. And Jack and I sat down. We had a few pops and he said to me, and I've met him a couple of times at the Cotton Bowl. He, of course, was already well on his way to being one of the best in the business. And he said to me, "Do you know any good football announcers? We're losing J.C. Politz. He's going back to Louisiana. It's just his mother left in the family down there, and he's going back to Lafayette. He's going to work in a little station there in Lafayette, and we're looking for somebody to do the football Cardinals." Well, we talked about KMOX, and everybody knew about KMOX. It was the number one sports station in the country, and at that time, everybody was very excited about talk radio and At Your Service, which Bob Hyland really invented. And anyway, to make a long story short, we talked, and I got a feel for what was going on, and I said, "Well, what's the job pay?" And it paid $5,000 more than I was making in Dallas, where I just had a raise turned down at KLIF, working for Gordon McClendon, who was a legendary sports broadcaster before he got into the family business, and they had theaters all over the country and radio stations and a 50,000 water in Mexico and everything else. Fantastic people. I loved working for them. But when I had the opportunity, and Sue and I had just been engaged to be married, I said, "Well, what's the matter with me?" And he said, "Would you be interested?" 2 weeks later, I was in Hyland's office and signed a deal with KMOX.
Well, and so you came to St. Louis to do the football Cardinals, do KMOX radio, and then you end up on TV with Channel 5. How did that happen?
I was 28 months, I guess, at KMOX, and you remember that the first year of the Blues, you probably don't remember, come to think of it.
I'm going to be honest, I don't remember that. It might have just gotten in there before I was born, but you were the original TV voice of the Blues, correct?
I was, and I really didn't know much about what I was doing, I'll tell you. And Jack was doing the radio.
He probably didn't know a whole hell of a lot more than you did about hockey, did he?
No. We were struggling, I can tell you that. But at the time, it didn't make any difference. We had a team, and it was great fun. And, you know, I worked with Gus Kyle, the old Northwest Mounted policeman who had played in the league, and he was a lot of fun to work with. And it was really an interesting experience because I don't suppose I had been to more than 3 or 4 hockey games in my entire life and knew really very little about the game. But I learned a lot, and Gus helped me, and a lot of the players helped me. Bob Plager passing the other day, I was thinking about Bob and how much he was helpful. And the players put up with us, and we got through the season. But while that was going on, Harold Grahams, who ran Pulitzer Broadcasting, apparently saw me doing the telecasts, and I had interested him in maybe taking a job over at Channel 5. And Sonny Randall, the old wide receiver of the football Cardinals, was doing their sports, but he really wasn't into it very much, and they were looking for somebody to really take their sports department over and try to make it go. And the next thing I know, make a long story short, they offer me a job that was much more lucrative than what I was making at KMOX. I mean, we had Harry Carey, we had Jack Buck, we had Skip Carey, and there was me. And but I took the job, and I hated to take it because I was so happy at KMOX, and working for Hyland was an experience. I mean, he hired me to do the football Cardinals, but I ended up doing At Your Service, and I ended up doing the 4th of July fireworks on radio, believe it or not, and things like that. You never knew what he was going to call you in and have you do, but it was interesting to make the move. It was something that he didn't like, and in fact, I don't think we spoke for almost 10 years before I finally had an opportunity to get together and smooth things over again, because he was very upset with me when I left. But that's neither here nor there. But at Channel 5, I had free reign, and I was really learning the television business because I had never done television news shows, never done sports news shows. I'd always done play-by-play on TV. And, of course, at that time, we were doing the Big 8 basketball game of the week. Gary Thompson from Ames, Iowa, the All-American, and I did that for 19 seasons. And it was a wonderful weekend, every weekend that we were doing college basketball. But anyway, that's how I got to Channel 5, and I was there for more than 20 years. And at the same time, they indicated they were going to talk to the people in New York and see if they couldn't get me some work at the network. And I got, I think, 3 football games my first year, and then they started putting me on their golf, and then I was doing basketball and
bowling too, right?
Horse racing, the Breeders' Cup. I mean, the Olympics. I had over 20 years at NBC, so it was a wonderful marriage. And the people here in St. Louis, who were running the station over the years, allowed me to slip away and do the network. And hired Ron Jacober. Ron was with me for nearly 15 years, I guess. and hired him away from Cam Wex, and then later he went back there, and a wonderful talent and a great friend and a tremendous worker and great writer. And he had a tough time because I mean, he'd be in the office and I'd be in the office on Wednesday. The phone would ring, somebody calling from New York saying, well, we need you to be in Keokuk, Iowa to do this or that on Saturday. And I'd say, Ron, you're going to have to work the weekend. And he never, it was always funny. I would go up to tell Ray Karpowitz when he was the general manager there. I said, Ray, I'm going to have to go for NBC this weekend. He says, well, that's all right. You got it all covered. Jacoby's going to handle it. And I said, yeah, everything's handled. And he said, well, just as long as you don't ask for any more money, it's okay.
Boy, you know what? The business really hasn't changed a whole lot when you say that. You know, I'm thinking of guys that, with this resume. Oh, like, you know, Al Troutwig nowadays, he does all these different sports in the Olympics. And I always joke when they like, hey, who's going to do the biathlon? Well, they're like, what's that? Well, skiing with a gun. Like, Troutwig will do it. Like, you have to be almost like a Swiss Army knife when NBC calls and says, and Chris Schenkel and these guys always it seemed to be less, I guess, sports specific back in the day for our announcers. Is that fair?
Well, it changed, really, I guess, with Kurt Gowdy. Kurt was the number one guy in the country. He did the Super Bowl. He did the Final Four. He did all of the big events at NBC. And all of a sudden, he was able to work out a deal where he went over to ABC to do the American Sportsman. And at the same time would continue to do everything at NBC. That kind of broke the mold because everybody coveted their sports announcers in those days. And they didn't let you go out and work on other networks. And then when Gowdy did that, it kind of opened the floodgates. And, you know, somebody would offer you something and you'd say, well, I mean, let Gowdy do it. Okay, all right, go ahead or whatever. But that changed things. And of course, some people were specialists. They did one sport or two sports. One of the things that helped me, frankly, was the fact that I was always an over-preparer. And I always tried to be really set to go on whatever I was assigned to do. And my jobs in a period of about 8 or 9 years at NBC was breaking in the new color man like Bob Greasy. And it was great fun and challenging. And I enjoyed that. And I also enjoyed the fact that I could get a phone call and in 2 or 3 days of homework, go somewhere and get through a broadcast. Jack Buck had that talent. He didn't even have to. You could blindfold Buck and take him somewhere and take the blindfold off and give him 10 minutes, and he'd do a brilliant job. But versatility helped me a great deal. Really, it did, because I did everything but women's field hockey, really.
And you probably could.
And back to our visit with Jay Randolph Sr. Love these stories. Can't wait to get to his Bob Costas take, his Mike Shannon story. Drinking Budweiser and Jack Daniels and driving through Iowa. I'm telling you, there's probably a screenplay in there. And we also asked Jay, what about a book after all the things that he has seen and done? The Kilcoin Conversation found at scoopswithdannymac.com. Also, we encourage you to subscribe. Just register at Spotify, iTunes, wherever you get your regular podcasts. Make sure you're signed up for the Kilcoin Conversation. That'll also get you Martin and Marlowe. Also, Hanging with Big Walt, Keith Kachuk. So make sure you get signed up. We appreciate you subscribing to the segments. Coming up, I think next week, Dave Parker, the Cobra. Fascinating career for him. And looking back on all the things that he went through, the highs and the lows. So make sure you are signed up for all of our segments. Appliance discounters, well aware of all the cannots that those other appliance guys are telling you. When you're in need of an appliance right away, they want to make your life easier. They've got the full in-stock 40,000-square-foot warehouse full of GE appliances. Time's difficult enough. You don't need to wait 2 or 3 months for that appliance. Get it in just a couple of days. Lowest price, GE rebates, great service, and in-stock only at Appliance Discounters. Shop any of their showrooms or online at theappliancediscounters.com. As always, our savings are your savings. Also, our great friends at Marie Davila Senior Living. Take that virtual tour at mariedavilla.com. That's M-A-R-I-D-E-V-I-L-L-A, mariedavilla.com. And Triad Bank. Get them on the web at Triad Banking or stop by and see them in Frontenac. It's on Clayton Road. So wherever you live, it's easy to get to. It's real close to that intersection of Highway 40 and Lindbergh, about a block west of Lindbergh on Clayton Road, our great friends at Triad Bank.
Did you love ponies when you were a kid? Did you grow up around the track?
My dad loved horse racing. My dad was a fine athlete in college, played basketball at a high level, and a real class tennis player, and also loved horse racing. And I started going to the racetrack with him when I was about 6 or 7 years old. Charlestown racetrack, about an hour from where we lived in Washington, D.C. while he was in Congress, and then over to Pimlico and around. And Dad had a lot of friends who owned horses, and he just loved horse racing. It was really a passion of his, along with politics. So naturally, I took to watching the horses. They were beautiful. Another thing I did that I should remember, I did a number of years of equestrian broadcasts on television. Yeah, that was great fun for covering like gold medalist Michael Matz, who later came on to train a Kentucky Derby champion. But the horse racing crowd in those days were wealthy, fun-loving, hardworking, and I always enjoyed those people over the years, although I am on the shelf these days.
I think Frank Cusumato, our friend, may have embellished a little bit, but he would swear when he was interning at Channel 5 that you would be coming back from the track at Fairmount Park, and if you missed the light or there was maybe a train in the railroad stoppage, he may have had to hop on and do the 10 o'clock sports because Jay was cutting it so close. What's accurate or no?
Accurate.
Guilty as charged. So you'd go, what, over on your dinner break and play a few ponies and then come back?
Yes, that's right. Not every night, but on a number of occasions I would do that. And if I missed at the railroad crossing and had to wait for the train, quite often I would park in the old lot there behind the station and run up the steps and through the door and walk right onto the set and start talking.
Well, and how much is sports back then, too? Was it highlight driven, or were you just kind of like, hey, it's Jay, and here's the scoreboard, and just kind of BS?
Well, we didn't have videotape when I first started. I mean, we'd do live commercials. Everything was on film. And, I mean, boy, when baseball season came, we had a film crew at the stadium. And, of course, if we were lucky enough to get a home run or a couple of runs scored in the first four or five innings, that was great because we had to get the film out of there at about 9 or 9:15 to get it to the lab so we could get it processed. And there was many a night, I'll tell you, when we would slap the film on, it was still wet and run it. I mean, it was always a fascinating thing to see what we were going to have. But there again, I had the ability to roll with whatever punches we had and come up with a story or two that maybe nobody else had, or an anecdote. And I did a lot of my own, well, all of my own talking, and nobody wrote for me. Gober, of course, later, as we got to the teleprompters and all of the bells and whistles, Jacober did a tremendous job in helping me through that period of time because I really wasn't very good at that kind of thing. But I would just look at the camera and look at the folks at home and tell them what I thought was going on in the world of sports.
What's your favorite event to go to? Would it be a Kentucky Derby over a Super Bowl or over a World Series or the Masters? I mean, is there, if you're just going as a fan, which one are you picking?
Oh, boy, I'd have liked to have been there on Saturday night. That was the greatest college basketball game I think I've ever seen. But college basketball was one of my loves. But, you know, I'm often asked what was my favorite event. And it would have to be the Olympics in Sapporo, Japan, a beautiful little town in the mountains on the island of Hokkaido, the northernmost island in the Japanese chain. I spent 28 days there doing the Olympics. But my first big moment, and really one of the biggest moments about my life, I talked about versatility. I was doing bobsled, luge, speed skating, ski jumping, and a couple of hockey games. And on the first day of the competition, the 70-meter ski jump was being held about 5 miles out of town on the side of this mountain. About 70,000 Japanese people and fans there from all over the world. And I had done a lot of work trying to learn about ski jumping. It's something I'd never done and something I'd never watched live before. And Art Devlin, who was an outstanding ski jumper and is still living in Lake Placid, New York, where he runs a little hotel that he owns there. He was my color man, and thank goodness he was there. But anyway, to make a long story short, a 17-year-old kid from a little farm up the road about 5 miles from the ski jump won the 70-meter ski jump. His name was Yukio Kasaya, and he instantly became a national hero in Japan, and he upset the apple cart. Nobody had realized that this kid had this kind of talent. He was just in it, and he wins the first gold medal that the Japanese ever won in the Winter Olympics, and NBC ran that segment back 4 or 5 times in the first week we were on the air from over there. It was the first Olympics ever televised via satellite. We had one satellite, and it had been up about 8 or 9 days before we tried to see if it worked.
And you doing all those various sports at one particular, you know, Winter Olympics, I felt sorry for myself. I'm working in Rhinelander, Wisconsin at the NBC affiliate, and we covered everything. Really small town that had a high school, and I had to go shoot the video of the gymnastics team. So I come back with the girls' gymnastics, and I'm sitting down to write my script, and I realize I have no idea what to say. Like, you know, they're running around. So I finally, the next day, I went over and asked the gymnastics coach. I said, what can I, you know, like, it's not a home run or a dunk. I'm like, what can I? And the woman said, you really want to focus on strong routine, or check out this routine. Well, I use that word routine about 4,000 times because I didn't know what the hell else to say, you know?
Well, I never liked, of course, on occasion I had to script highlights and stuff like that, but I always, my great love was doing it live. I loved, as I mentioned, the Big Eight basketball that we did for 19 seasons, Gary Thompson and I, and we still keep in touch. And he was such a joy to work with. And then doing basketball, a lot of people forget that NBC had the Final Four.
Al McGuire,
and,
right?
Al McGuire, Billy Packer.
Dick Enberg.
And Dick Enberg. We lost that to CBS when the fellow who was running the network in New York and Walter Byers, the head of the NCAA out in Kansas City, got into a real fight. And Byers just said, well, goodbye, you're out.
And CBS has never given it back, have they?
I don't know. It was like somebody had struck me in the heart with a stick. But that's show business, right?
How about some word association? I'm just going to mention some names, and then you tell me what comes to mind. Let's start with Jack Buck.
Oh, brilliant. So clever. An ability to enthrall you with his vocabulary and his knowledge.
How about Joe Buck?
Joe is refreshing. He's certainly led the new breed. I'm very fond of his work, and I think it'll stand up over the long haul. I know how proud his dad would be if he had an opportunity to be around today, and I'm sure he's listening somewhere to these wonderful games that he does. But Joe likes golf, incidentally. Loves it.
Yeah, he does. And I remember an interview with Jack Buck. It would have been early coming back to St. Louis for me, but I threw Joe's name out there, and he said, "How about that talent, huh?" And he said, "Better than the old man already." And so I think he knew early on how good he was going to be. Did you and Costas, you wouldn't have been at KMOX together, right? But you would have been in town when he came along.
No, when Costas came out here to do the APA, I was just moved, over to Channel 5, but I got to know Costas well, but it took a little while. I wasn't quite sure what we had, you know. He was very smooth. I liked his voice. And I never will forget, I was convinced one night, I was in New York with the Cardinals who were doing baseball, and he had invited me to come down to a little restaurant on 3rd Avenue where sports writers and sportscasters would gather late in the evening. And I'm talking about late. They'd start getting in there, I guess, around 10 o'clock in the evening and sit around and have a few beers and whatever and talk about what was going on in the world of sports. And I went... I remember going to this little place, and Runyon's was the name of it, Runyon's. And sitting there and listening to Costas, and I realized this guy has got something. He really is. I mean, there are a lot of guys in the room in their 30s, 40s, 50s. And they're all enthralled by what he's saying, and I was enthralled, too, his knowledge and his ability. And I never thought I'd hear a better Olympic host than Jim McKay. McKay was a friend of mine, and he loved horse racing. And I would see him on a number of occasions, and Jim McKay was fabulous. I mean, wide world of sports and everything. But tell you, when it got to the point where Costas was still in the Olympics, it was just marvelous. In Barcelona, where the work was tough and the venues were tough and there all kinds of problems, you would never know it. He was just brilliant on the air, and I think he, in my mind, is the best Olympic host we've ever had. And I'm sorry he stepped away, but he stepped away from NBC. They've had a parting of the ways, and we will be able to hear him on Major League Baseball, thank goodness. And Bob is a really outstanding person, a wonderful guy, and I am... better off for knowing him and listening to him, and learned a lot from watching him in action.
How about, maybe we'll finish with this one, Mike Shannon.
one in a million, world's strongest man. He is just, I was thinking the other day about the fact that he said this is his last season and 50 years with the Cardinals. And I've got a story when we get back to the Masters to tell you about Shannon, but he to me is a natural, and despite the rough edges, you gotta love him. I mean, he's just an amazing person, and I was interested. I understand that our friend Rick Hummel is going to pen a book about him this year.
Oh, good. I did not know that. Good.
Yeah. And
what about you? What about a book for Jay? Have you ever done a book or thought about it?
No, I thought about it, and a lot of people ask me, but I don't think I'm going to go that route. Buck once told me after he had written one of his books, I think he wrote three, he once told me, he says, let me tell you something. He always called me kid, you know. He said, let me tell you something, kid. It's a lot of work and you don't make any money.
Well,
but I don't think I'm going to write a book. No,
but Shannon, you'd be the one to know this. I swear, when I was in like grade school or high school, and it may have only been 1 year, Mike Shannon either did Mizzou or Big Red as the color analyst in football. I swear, because I could still hear Bill Wilkerson saying, he's at the 20, the 10, and you'd hear Shannon go, no flags at all. And you'd hear him in the background. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Was it Mizzou and Cardinals?
Mizzou.
Okay.
And I say at some point in time I'll tell you a little story about his football days at Missouri and his football days here, but well, I might as well tell it now if we've got time.
Yeah, legendary athlete, right?
Well, he was an amazing athlete in high school and just dominated every sport that he played. And, of course, he was given a scholarship to Missouri and went down there to play football for them. And at that time, he was really figured to be apparently not only in these parts but around the country as being one of the best quarterback prospects, one of the best football prospects around. And he was there only one semester, I believe, because the Cardinals came, and I think the figure was $5,000 signing bonus, and he decided to leave school, and it was, I'm sure, a tough decision for him. I've talked to him about it, but he said, I had to get the money, you know, and so anyway,
I think Dan Devine said he would have won the Heisman. That's what he believed, had he stuck with football.
No, it wasn't Dan Devine. Go back a little farther than that.
Well, Onofrio?
No.
Oh, no.
This man coached at Arkansas.
Frank Broyles. I'm sorry, Frank Broyles. I threw out the wrong name. Frank Broyles. That's it.
That's all right. Frank Broyles.
Here you are remembering stuff that happened in 1952, and I can't remember Shannon's college coach.
Well, anyway, Broyles signed the scholarship and brought Shannon to Missouri, and was very thrilled about it. Shortly after that, Broyles left for Arkansas, and of course, the rest is history down there. And Frank Broyles was a member at Augusta National. And he'd been given a membership there and was highly respected. And Broyles was, at one point, very close to being named the chairman of the Augusta National after the passing of the current chairman. But to make a long story short, I was in Chicago doing a doubleheader doubleheader baseball game with the Cardinals and the Cubs at the end of one of the seasons up there. and we weren't in contention, and they canceled the second game. But Bill Bolster, who was then the general manager of Channel 5, had set up a golf game for us in Waterloo, Iowa, his hometown. And I had rented a Lincoln town car, and Shannon and Bolster and I pack into this town car at Wrigley Field, and I'm the designated driver, and we head out for Waterloo, where we're going to play golf the next day with one of the executives from the broadcast side. And make a long story short, we get to Galena, Illinois, and we'd stop two or three times. Every time there was a Budweiser sign, Shannon would want to stop and go in and shake a few hands and so forth and so on. But anyway, in Galena, Illinois, we stop at a little hotel there, and hardly anybody in the place. But Bolster gets on the phone and makes a couple phone calls. The next thing I know, there must be 30 people in the place. Bill's father had been in the retail clothing business, and he had a store in Galena, one of a number of stores that he had, I guess, in Iowa and about that part of the country. But we had quite a party. We really did. And it was now getting pretty late, and we wanted to try to get to Waterloo that evening. So I guess around 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock, we get back in the Lincoln, and Shannon has got a cardboard box full of Budweiser, a little Jack Daniels in there, and a little gin, and this and that and everything. And he's sitting up in the front seat with this thing between his legs, the box and everything, and I'm driving, and Bill is taking a nap, and we're on our way now to Waterloo, and all of a sudden we cross over into Iowa, and about 10 miles into Iowa, the siren comes up, and here comes a state trooper after us, and I pull over, and I said, "Mike, you got to get rid of that." And he said, "Where would you want me to put it?" And anyway, we pulled the car over, and the first thing, Bolster just pops out of the back seat and goes back to the car behind us that has stopped us. I don't know to this day what Bill told this guy. He never would tell me, the state trooper. But he was talking to him for about 5 or 6, 7 minutes, and I was telling Shannon, "Boy, we are in trouble. We're going right to the pokey, I guarantee you." And I don't think they had breathalyzers, thank goodness. But anyway, Bill comes back, and he says, "Okay, guys, let's go." So off we go, and he never did tell me what he told that guy, but the guy didn't charge us, didn't give us a ticket, nothing. So anyway, 10 or 15, 20 miles, and we're driving, and all of a sudden Bill says, "You know, Mike, I never ask you." He said, "How good a football player were you?" And Mike says, "Well, let me tell you something, big fella. If I'd have stayed at Missouri, I would have won the Heisman Trophy." And Bill's laughing and giggling and talking about it and all and everything else. Well, to make a long story short, 2 years later, Bill and I are playing at Augusta with some friends at the Masters. And we're playing gin rummy in the afternoon after we get through. And then you get cleaned up and go down to the main building to have dinner and walk in. And Michael Jordan and some guys are sitting in the first table to the right. And we're seated over just beyond them about 20 feet and get seated. And I look across the room, and Frank Broyles is sitting at a table over there with another gentleman. And I said to Bill, I said, "Frank Broyles is here." And I had met him on occasion. I said, "Come on over." So we go over and say hello. So I went over and I reintroduced myself to Broyles and introduced him to Bolster and talk for a couple minutes. And all of a sudden, Bolster says, "Coach Broyles, I got to ask you, how good a player you recruited him was Mike Shannon?" And Broyles looked him up right straight in the eye, and he said, "You know, Mr. Bolster, if Shannon had stayed at Arkansas, he probably would have won the Heisman Trophy."
And there it is.
There it is.
From his own mouth. Oh, my goodness. What a payoff.
So
I'm struck by you and Shannon and Bill Bolster, who later founded CNBC and was a New York powerhouse for NBC.
Right.
I'm picturing Thelma and Louise. You guys,
yeah. We were quite a threesome, no question about that. But and Bolster, of course, has passed away, and we miss him so dearly. But Bill said to me, "Don't you ever tell Shannon he said that." I said, "Are you kidding?" First thing I'll tell him when I see him, you know, because I mean it was. But
there's the proof.
That's a great story.
I love it. Hey, let's finish with this. We'll clip and save Jay Randolph's bold prediction. Who wins the Masters this year?
Spieth
coming in hot.
Yep, I'm going for the chalk. It should be very interesting. It really should be.
Well, Jay, great to talk to you. So much fun, not only on Masters Week, but I think, you know, we visited over the years, but I just sort of wanted to put it to tape, all these great career moments. We didn't even mention this guy was like the original voice of the Marlins down in South Florida and then working with the Reds. And just, you should write a book, but I think Jack Buck may have nailed it, the work and not enough money. But, Jay, so great to hear your voice. It sounds that voice, if you would just end with indeed, indeed, it'll make my day.
All right, Mike. Michael, I don't know what Michael's doing today, but I know I'm looking forward to his last season on the mic, and I look forward to seeing you soon, and it's been a very pleasant time visiting with you, indeed, indeed.
The segment would not have been complete without Jay's famous line, indeed, indeed. Well, he has still got the voice and the memory. I hope to be 87, and if I make it to 87, I hope I can remember stories in such great detail. I mean, I don't remember some stuff that happened last week. It's unbelievable what's in that memory bank. So hope you enjoyed it. It's a little longer visit than we normally have, but fun story time with the one and only Jay Randolph Sr. Hope you enjoy the Masters this week as well. Thanks for checking out the Kilcoin Conversation. As always, we appreciate you listening to our segments as well as taking care of our sponsors, Appliance Discounters, Marie Davila Senior Living, and Triad Bank. I'm Martin Kilcoin. We'll talk to you again soon and look for more great content, as always, at ScoopsWithDannyMac.com.